I'm very exhausted now. If you don't start talking, I'm going to collapse in front of you. So please. Now, you were supposed to read the section of the book by Christopher Vogler, The Writer's Journey on the Hero's Journey. And since this book was partly inspired by Vogler knowing that Star Wars had been based on research that Lucas had conducted partly by not only reading all kinds of myths and fairy tales, but reading about them, and in particular reading Joseph Campbell, when he wrote his book, Vogler illustrated a lot of what he said with Star Wars. You know what I mean? So a lot of what we're talking about is actually in the text. The text, the main example in the whole book is Star Wars. Nevertheless, it's not a mechanical exercise to apply the Hero's Journey model to Star Wars. So on the one hand, we'll do something with just ticking boxes. But the interesting thing is the conversations we're going to have about the boxes. So I gave you a few questions. What I will try to remind you is that before the hero's journey always starts in the ordinary world, but there may be a prologue. Yeah. So before we get to the hero, his or her ordinary world, and then the journey into the special world, we may have a prologue. Unless you try to construct Star Wars as Leia's hero's journey, which is possible, but it's tricky. It's not the obvious thing to do. Unless you do that, if you decide that Luke is the hero, you do indeed have a prologue in the special world. Yeah, that's everything before Luke makes his first appearance. That's basically a prologue. And we may want to talk about that in a minute. But normally what you have is that, say, out of 120 minutes, the first quarter is set in the ordinary world. Then there's a transition into the special world, which is a kind of exaggerated version, a fantastical version, of certain aspects of the ordinary world and the contents within it. And then towards the end, you get a return to the ordinary world after about three quarters through the film. So, and in the middle, you have what is called the supreme ordeal. So that's another turning point. So you have four quarters. The first quarter, ordinary world, the second and third quarter, and the special world, half by the supreme ordeal, and the final quarter, the ordinary world. That's roughly what you expect. You know, it might vary. There might be, you know, the times might be shifting around a little bit. But that's roughly what you expect. Now, what is the hero's ordinary world? What are the problems that he has to confront in this ordinary world? How would you characterize, if we select Luke? As I said, you could do it for Leia, but that would be a bit trickier. But let's say Luke is the hero. So the first task of the story is to give us some characterization of what that ordinary world is like. So the first step in every narrative is the outline of the ordinary world and the position of the hero within it and any problems that might occur at this moment. So how would you characterize, does Luke Skywalker have issues? Any suggestions? What kind of issues might he have?
To go out and to enjoy the world.
Yeah, so he wants to explore. Yeah? Is there a problem with that? Why doesn't he just do it?
His uncle has a problem with it.
Huh?
His uncle has a problem with it.
Why?
Because he wants to help from him on his farm.
Yeah? So, parental, I'm putting that in inverted commas, parental control, because he's not old enough yet. He doesn't control his own destiny. there is a father figure who controls it. I mean, in this case, it's his uncle. Parental control prevents him from following his bliss, as it were. What else? Any other issues? Teenage boy, any other issues, explicit or implicit?
All his friends have left already, so he's alone basically.
Yeah, so loneliness. What else? Anything else? Anything he wishes, implicitly or explicit, any problem?
He wants to go to the academy.
Yeah, so explore, train. Yeah, he wants to go out and train for something, in this particular case for a glamorous career. And that ties in with exploring the world. Yeah, and that is prevented by the parental control and the, let's call it household commitments that he has, or household duties. I mean, in this particular case, it's not in the household, it's, you know, on the farm. He has duties there, he's needed. What else?
He wants to learn about his father, or about...
Is that made explicit?
Well...
At the very beginning of his appearance, is it made explicit?
Well, no.
Yeah? But what about his father? He's really dead. Yeah? So, he's an orphan. Yeah? That's an issue. He hasn't got any parents. So his father is dead, his mother is dead. And the conversation indicates that there's a mystery around the father. Luke doesn't necessarily know there's a mystery, but we know when, you know, aunt and uncle look at each other, he's like his father. That's what I fear. Yeah, so we know there's a mystery surrounding the father. So you're deducing from that that Luke wants to know what that mystery is. But I think Luke doesn't even know initially that there is a mystery. We know. So we know there's a mystery right from the get-go when he had this look between aunt and uncle, mystery surrounding father. You know, but having a dead father and a dead mother, pretty bad to begin with. Mystery surrounding father. Yeah, so the problem of death looms very large in his life. Anything else? How would we characterize the society he's part of? Can we characterize that at all? It seems to be a farm, and there's some traders, but there's also all kinds of hostile engines. You know, there's the sand people and whatnot in the desert. So there's hostile groups surrounding the farm. Yeah? So it's really like a, you know, an American farmer or cattle owner in Indian territory, surrounded by Indians. Yeah, so there's a hostile relationship there, which adds to the loneliness. Yeah, because there's no people like him. The only people around him are these sand people and occasionally these traders coming through. That's all he has. Anything else? Okay, now, shall we look at this again? Here's a teenager who wants to leave home, but his parents just damn good in the way. And they never let him do what he wants. And he has all kinds of, you know, awkward duties at home. And he feels very lonely. Now, that's any teenager anywhere in the world ever. Yeah, that's why it's called ordinary world. This is completely ordinary. Any teenager anywhere in the world. And you can probably go, I mean, hunter-gatherer tribes, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago probably had to confront the same thing. They dealt with it differently. But it's the same thing. This is the basic description of a stage in life, that of the young man, or we could try the same with the young woman. The only thing that is different is that he's orphaned, so his relationship is not with his parents but with his adoptive parents, that there appears to be a mystery surrounding his father, he doesn't even know about it, and he lives in totally hostile territory. Those things are different, but that's just any teenager ever. Except for one thing, what's missing? As an implicit, what does the teenager want? No, he doesn't just want to go out into the world, he wants to have a
Girl.
Girl, yeah. So implicitly, it's not just loneliness, absence of friends, but it's also, there's the lack of a girl. Yeah? So that's the situation, and that's any teenager. Yeah. So that's why it's called ordinary world. Yes, it's a sand planet and blah, 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 but that's all irrelevant. That's what you're invited to hook into. That's familiar to anyone everywhere. These things are a bit rarer. Okay, now, let's just jump through the whole narrative to the very end. Where is Luke at the very end? And have these problems been addressed throughout his adventure? Has he trained? Has he been trained? The answer is yes, but he wanted to train as a pilot, and what was he really trained as? Something much better. He's now on the way of, he has done the pre-training to become a Jedi Knight. Yeah, so he wanted to just be a pilot, and he does become a pilot. I mean, you know, he does fly the spacecraft in the crucial attack, but he's gone much further than just being a pilot, because he's also on the way to become a Jedi. So, tick, chief, that explored the world, blah, 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 all the chief. Parental control, has he got any left?
No.
How does that happen?
Fairness?
Because they all probably get killed! You know, that is actually quite shocking if you think about it. He starts out an orphan, then his adoptive parents get killed, then his another adoptive father gets killed. It's bloody gruesome, isn't it? But it makes him free, so no more parental control. But guidance. But he has spiritual paternal guidance. Again, much better. Yeah? Not someone who says, oh, go out on the farm and clean up the mess or whatever, but someone who says, trust the fortune. Yeah? Much better. So spiritual paternal guidance he has. The loneliness, has that been addressed? Yeah?
He found sister.
No. We're only talking about the first Star Wars film, not knowing anything about anything else. He's found friends. Yeah, so he has plenty of friends. He's found friends. And of course, he also found a role within the whole organization, the Rebel Alliance. Yeah, so he's found friends and a kind of professional role. So that's good. Professional role, that's good. So, tick. Has he found a girl? Sort of. Yeah? Unresolved. At the end, Leia is sticking the medal both to him and Han Solo. And my money would be on Han Solo, sister or not, because they don't know this, and we don't know it, yeah? The first Star Wars on its own, Darth Vader is not Luke's father, and Leia is not his sister. The first Star Wars on its own is not functioning like that. We're only talking initially on its own terms. So, yes, he has found a girl, but he's still in courtship. Yeah? He's still courting her. He hasn't, you know, tied the knot yet. He hasn't gotten any, you know? So this is half resolved. There is a girl that he focuses on, but they're not together yet. And of course he has a serious rival. And my money would be on Han Solo anyway, in that rivalry. Yeah, so that's unresolved. Household farm duties have been replaced through a professional role, much more exciting. Okay. Mystery surrounding father. Has he learned something about his father? In the first one.
Well, he's learned that he used to be Jedi Knight.
Yeah. And was killed by someone else. Yeah. So, what we call it, tragic, heroic death. That's comforting. You know, your father's not some loser who drank himself to death or, you know, was killed in a car accident. You know, he's a tragic, heroic warrior, Jedi Knight. Now, that's pretty cool. That mystery, obviously, that's only half the answer, but that will only be revealed in the second part. So that's pretty cool. The hostility between humans and the surrounding aliens, has that problem been addressed? Okay, it's not on his home planet. What's it called again? Tatooine. Not on Tatooine, because he doesn't return to Tatooine. But I would suggest it has been addressed because the Rebel Alliance is sort of cross-species. Yeah, so there's no opposition anymore between humans, human farmers, and some, you know, sort of engines surrounding them. We now have an alliance, a Rebel Alliance, which involves various species. The most notable, of course, is the Wookiee. And if you have noted, he doesn't get a medal. Now, you could understand if the medal was pinned, you know, then you would think, ah, you can't do that to a Wookiee. But the medal is put over the, you know, so why does he not get a medal? Have you thought about that? Have you ever thought about that? Why does the Wookiee not get a medal at the end? Some people say it's very racist. It's the beginnings of the whole Jar Jar Binks fiasco that the Wookiee doesn't get a medal. But nevertheless, this is allegorically resolved. This idea of humans and engines, hostile engines, surrounding them is because we have a cross-species alliance. Now, the most important, the most extreme thing, what does he learn about death? What does he learn about death in the course of the story? Death is not the end. Very important message. Yes, he has everyone dying on him, but the last one who dies stays on as a spirit. Yeah. So what he gets is comfort. Comfort through the Force that death is not the end. Everything survives somehow. Now, not everything that survives can communicate with him. Only Obi-Wan can do that. But death is not the end. So that's a very important lesson for someone who has been traumatized by the death of everyone he loves. It's a very important lesson to learn, that is not the end. That the soul or whatever it is exists within the Force, and that, you know, in exceptional cases it can even communicate with you. So that's the purpose of the whole story. It's that Luke learns that there are spiritual aims in life, not just, you know, trivial career aims. Now, I want to be a pilot. It's glamorous. It's exciting. No, there's something way beyond, which is to become a Jedi Knight, which is a spiritual thing. And also, of course, it's part of a much broader conflict. Parental control is replaced again through spiritual parental guidance. So, in a sense, what you do is you internalize your parents. Growing up means not to be guided by your parents as people, but by what you have learned from them, what you have internalized. As we said, the one thing that is slightly unresolved is the rivalry about the girl. But everything else seems to be... I mean, this is a missolution, but we don't know that at the end of Star Wars. We don't know that the mystery hasn't really been resolved yet at all. We think we know what happened, but we're wrong, but we don't know we're wrong. So do you see, that's the point of the story, to get Luke from here to here. And a lot of these things are things that any teenager will confront. Some of the things are a bit exaggerated. You know, that your separation from your parents on some level is like them dying, even if they don't die. That's just exaggerated by making them dead. That you have to internalize your parents on some level, you know, to live your life. You have to, on some level, internalize the lessons that they can teach you, the guidance that you can teach. That's also exaggerated by introducing spirits. But basically, a lot of this is what every person, every teenager, every person in their life who's older, who's a teenager older than teacher, has to go through, or has already gone through. And every child, of course, knows they will have to go through that. So the whole story is only about getting us to this point. And all the fantasy and everything is only there, all the special world is only there to get us to this point. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. Yeah? It's a person who knows that their aims in life have been limited, that there are higher things to strive for, that death is not the end, that parents ultimately become part of you, that loneliness is not the final condition, although it may feel like it when you're a teenager, that hostility between groups can be overcome in alliances and so on. Okay. Where's the thing? There it is. Yeah, so that's the first step. Ordinary world. Now, ideally, what would happen is that the world from which the hero comes would be transformed by his return. And the problem here is that he never returns to Tatooine. Yeah, so it's in some ways, it's not as extreme as Avatar, where he never even leaves Pandora. He leaves the space, the world of space battle. He leaves that, but he ends up on some rebel moon rather than on his home planet. So this transformation of the society he comes from is a minor theme in Star Wars the first episode, or rather the fourth. Okay. So that's the overall trajectory. So what I want to emphasize is this is all... There are some fantasy elements here, but this is perfectly average human development. Yeah, everyone can identify with what's going on there. You can dress it up in space garb or anything like that, but that's not the point. The point really is the underlying issues that everyone, every human being growing up has to confront. And there are some of the answers, and as you notice, spirituality is absolutely central to these answers. But you can psychologize it. You can say it's not the spirit of a parent that guides you, it's the lessons you have internalized that guides you. But it amounts to a similar thing, I guess. Okay, so what's the next step? What's the call to adventure? Once we know the hero, in his ordinary, I'm going to say his from now on, it could be her, but in this case it is a his, so let's just take. So what's the call to adventure for Luke? Call to adventure means something comes probably out of the special world, which is a completely fantastical world, and sort of grabs you and says, come. So what's the call to adventure for Luke?
When he learns about
Obi-Wan Kenobi, he wants to find out who he is.
How does he find
out about... From the robot. What is it that the robot...
message from Leia.
Yeah? Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. Yeah? So that's the call to adventure. Now, it's not a call to adventure addressed to him, ironically. Yeah, you're quite right. He has to process this and get curious and think, oh, yeah, I can get involved in this. Why does he get involved in this? Okay, there's natural curiosity, but also, what's the first thing he says?
Because of the girl.
He says, oh, she's beautiful. Yeah. In retrospect, you think, ooh. But at the time, you wouldn't know this, so it's fine. It's perfectly fine. So the call to adventure gives him two things. He knows there's some battle going on, and Princess Leia, but she's a princess, you know what I mean? So she must have an important role. And he wants to become a pilot. He wants to play some military role. So it appeals to his sense of adventure, yeah, which he has anyway, but also, of course, his romantic longings. She's beautiful. That's the first thing he says. Now, the interesting thing is, the call to adventure calls you into a world where you may lose limb and life and maybe more than your life. I mean, that's quite important. In the truly mythical story, it's not just that you risk everything when you enter the special world. Everything. You lose everything potentially that is familiar to you, but you may lose more than your life. Darth Vader lost more than his life. He lost his soul. You know, that's what the prequel trilogy is all about. How did Anakin Skywalker lose his soul? Which is, in a sense, worse than losing your life. So you put everything at risk, which means when the call comes, what do? You refuse the call. The call comes, and you say, yeah, better not. And way too dangerous. Yeah. So how does Luke refuse the call? He does it many times.
He says he has other responsibilities.
At what point?
When Obi-Wan said to come back.
Yeah, but that's very late. Does he refuse the call early on? So, what does he do when he sees the call? Well, first of all, he gets tricked into switching the whole thing off. Then he gets tricked into releasing R2-D2, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to see the message again, you have to do this and that. And of course, the message goes away, and he now has released R2-D2. Unconsciously, perhaps, you know, it's like, let him go, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Maybe. Well, of course, he doesn't know that. But the story knows that Luke is tricked into not only stopping the message, but letting R2-D2 escape. Then he gets told that, you know, Obi-Wan is just this, you know, weird loner living God knows where. And Luke doesn't say, yeah, but I need to find out. How is the call renewed? Yeah, when you refuse the call always has to be renewed so that you can refuse it again.
Well, he goes after R2.
Yeah, so when he realizes that R2-D2 is gone, the call to adventure is renewed. So he's forbidden to go out, but this time he says, I'm going to try. In the process of doing that, he meets the sand people, gets knocked over, indicating how dangerous it is to follow the call to adventure. He could have been killed by the sand people. So he meets Obi-Wan, who rescues him from the sand people. And then, what does Obi-Wan do in order to renew the call?
Tells him about his father.
Yeah, so your father was a knight, saying, you must be a knight. And then he gives him the sword. Phallus Schmallus. Yeah? So here's the big stick of your father. That should be your big stick. You know what I mean? And Luke says, nah. You know, I can talk the talk, but I'm not going to walk the walk. This whole big stick thing is not my business. And then Obi-Wan says, no, come with me. We have to fly such and such and do these things. And he says, no, I have to go back. Who said that? I have to go home and I have to be a farm boy. Yeah? And that's very important in a well-told story, is that the call to adventure, because it implies that you risk absolutely everything, more than your life. You risk absolutely everything. That's why it has to be refused, because it's such a dangerous thing to do. And then it has to be renewed, and then it's refused again, and it has to be renewed. What makes him accept the call? Yeah, they're killed. Aunt and uncle are killed. So it's almost like the stormtroopers are the only ones who can make him accept the call by killing the rest of his family. Okay. Now, also in the ordinary world, he meets the mentor. Sorry, this doesn't quite fit in, sorry. So first of all, the ordinary world is introduced with all its problems, then there's a call to adventure, then there's the refusal of the call, and in that period, at some point, he meets the mentor. Now the mentor, what's the role of the mentor in the hero's journey? What qualifies the mentor to do that?
Because he's Obi-Wan Kenobi in his own.
Can you speak more abstractly?
Past experience.
In the special world. Yeah? The mentor already was in the special world. And that's why he can be a guide to the hero into the special world. Because he knows the special world. Yeah? It's very important. Now, Obi-Wan is a bit of a, you know, the other thing that Vogler says, which is very interesting, you could actually take any character in a hero's journey and try to understand what their hero's journey was. A mentor is someone who has successfully undergone the hero's journey. He's gone into the special world and come back with a lesson to teach. That lesson is then taught to the next protagonist. Darth Vader has his own hero's journey. He never came back out of the special world. Yeah, he's stuck, especially at the Supreme Ordeal, he was turned into evil, and he never came back out of that. Yeah, so every character in a hero's journey that the hero encounters is on their own hero's journey. The mentor has once successfully completed, so that experience, that makes him awesome. That he knows what the special world is like. And the special world is the sphere of space and the Force. Yeah, so it's space and the Force. And Obi-Wan knows about space and space adventure, and he knows about the Force. And that knowledge he can then convey to Luke. Now, why Obi-Wan ends up... I mean, I never quite understood all aspects of the prequels. How does Obi-Wan end up being this miserable hermit on this desert planet, you know, lingering on, you know, watching... Did he actually intentionally end up on Tatooine to be reasonably close to Luke? I think that's the implication, when you've seen all the films, that he intentionally... He doesn't by accident, out of all planets in the universe, he doesn't by accident end up on Tatooine, I think. But it's quite weird, because in the first Star Wars, it's very strange that he would just pop up out of nowhere. You know, why would this Jedi Knight be on Tatooine, coincidentally, where Luke is? That's a bit of a much of a coincidence. But let's not go into that. Okay, so the first threshold is exactly where you move from your ordinary world into the special world. What's the first threshold? What's the first threshold? Yeah? So between your ordinary world and the special world, there is a point where you make a very decisive transition. Where is that in Star Wars?
The meeting of Han Solo.
Yeah, that's part of it. Where does that take place? In the cantina? Where is the cantina? Mos Eisley. Mos Eisley? What is Mos Eisley? A spaceport! What is a spaceport? It's where people who live on the planet enter into space. Yeah? That's the transition. So it's a spaceport. Within that spaceport, there's the cantina where all kinds mix. And that's where he meets Han Solo, and we come back to that in a minute. So the first threshold is the marker of the transition from the ordinary world and the special. What happens shortly before they enter? Immediately after they enter Mos Eisley, before they go into the cantina, is there anything significant that happens? Which gives us a sense that we're now entering some very different universe.
Han Solo shot first.
Yeah, but that's in the cantina. Before they enter the cantina.
No, they are looking for the robots, so they are on the hostile enemy, or on the hostile territory.
But how... Yes, good. So, the first encounter with the enemy. So, threshold guardians. On the threshold, there's various people marking that this is going to be a dangerous transition. So the first encounter with the stormtroopers would be one of those stormtroopers. SS will. What else happens before they enter the cantina? The stormtroopers look for the droids. What? These are not the droids you're looking for.
They want to use this force.
Exactly. The first use of the force. Don't forget that the transition from the ordinary world into the special world is a transition from, you know, where there's no magic to where there's magic, as it were. Where there is the Force at work. And we see it for the first time, we see it when there's the Jedi mind trick. Yeah. So for the first time we see evidence that it's not just about having a big stick, but it is about your mind, it's about the spirit world. It's about being in tune with a higher spiritual force. So that happens. So the transition, also what happens to Luke when he enters the cantina, he gets into a lot of trouble. And of course, he fails to defend himself. So what do we see for the first time? A lightsaber in action. Yeah. Appropriately, of course, it's sort of castrating someone else. So this whole thing about big sticks, and it's really very Freudian. So the lightsaber in action is for the first time seen. That magical weapon is seen. You know, I prefer this whole Jedi mind trick thing, but the whole first threshold, the marker is also that the lightsaber is in action to protect Luke against the hostile inhabitants of the cantina. Yeah, that's a pretty good first threshold, isn't it? It's the threshold between being on the planet and being in space. Between a world where there's no evidence that there is a force to a world where the force is alive. From a world in which, you know, lightsabers are hidden away to a world in which lightsabers are used. To a world in which Luke has a fairly safe place, and a world in which he has absolutely no place and no security whatsoever. That's very clear in the cantina. He would probably die in the cantina if it wasn't for Obi-Wan. Okay. So, now we have we're past the first threshold. Now, either before, during, or after, we have test allies and enemies. Now, what tests are there for Luke in this period from the time he comes to the first threshold to until they get to the Death Star? What are the tests for him? So the first test is, can he defend himself in the cantina? He fails it. What's the next test for him? Because once you enter the special world, you have to be tested. And that test may initially will reveal your weaknesses. So what else is he tested as or at?
He is blindfolded, and then he's trying to track the lightsaber for the first time, blindfolded.
Yeah? So he fails the test without being blindfolded, but he passes the test when he trusts in Obi-Wan. You see, it's not about heroism in the sense of being very good with your big stick. It really is not a masculinist film, honestly. It's not interested in muscles and big dicks and all that. It's the exact opposite. The lightsaber is not what it's all about. It's your mindset. And the most important thing that allows him to pass the test is to have himself blindfolded, trust Obi-Wan, and trust the Force. That's the test he passes. As long as he doesn't trust the Force, he fails the test, because he can't defend himself against the little thing that attacks him. So he fails a couple of tests, but he then passes one through trust. Trust in his mentor, trust in the Force. And it's very clear that Han Solo thinks this is all nonsense. This is mumbo jumbo. So we have to talk about that in a moment. Who are his allies? Who are his allies? I mean, obviously there's the mentor. Are there any other allies that Luke acquires in that period?
The droids.
Yeah, the droids. They're already there even before Obi-Wan. Anyone else? What about Han Solo? What's his relationship with Han Solo as an ally? How would you characterize it?
I think the Han Solo is like an old school character, like the weapons and the muscle. He doesn't trust the Force.
He's a pretty phallic character initially, and you know, as soon as he meets Leia, there's a lot of, you know, he is everything that a teenager might dream to be. He's totally independent, he has his weapons, he shoots people. You know, even unprovoked, you know, they changed that in the special edition, but he just shoots the other guy. He has a big, you know, homemade spaceship. He's basically an ego ideal, an older brother type or an ideal for Luke. But he has one weakness. What's Han's weakness in terms of being a true hero? He's selfish. What did you say?
Greed.
Yeah, selfish. He's actually selfish. He does things for himself and maybe for his Wookiee, but he's actually selfish. And the true definition of a hero is you have to be selfless. So in actual fact, we could say Han Solo, in the way he initially presents himself, is actually a step towards the dark side. Because as you will see in these kinds of stories, the key definition of a villain is selfishness. And the key aspect of the hero that he's able to change, and that it's changed towards altruism, to helping others. Yeah, so Han Solo is an ambiguous character. He's someone that Luke aspires to be like, but he's also someone who points initially in the wrong direction, towards selfishness. Of course, Han Solo is on his own hero's journey. By the end of the film, he has overcome his selfishness. That's very important. But initially, he's a very ambiguous. Now, who's the enemy? There's some assorted stormtroopers. And there's, of course, Darth Vader. And the funny thing is that Darth Vader, we talked about already, Darth Vader is a mirror image, as it were. A kind of mirror image to Obi-Wan. Yeah, we talked about this. They're both people who are out of step with their time. They don't believe in technology ultimately. They believe in the Force as being more forceful than anything else. And they're being ridiculed for it by people around them. They treat the people around them differently once they're ridiculed. You know, one does this, and the other, you know, just doesn't bother to even engage. So that's quite interesting, that the enemy, which is shown, the chief enemy, is actually the exact mirror image of the mentor. And I think that's very important, that a lot of these characters that you encounter in the special world are either mirror images of each other, or they are mirror images of you. So if you were to take the first trilogy, you know what happens at the right center of the first trilogy? Right in the middle of all three episodes, if you go right in the middle, what happens? Luke, on that planet where he's being trained by Yoda, is told to go into a cave. And he's supposed to go into the cave, you know, without emotion and without a weapon and without anything. Yeah? What does he do? He takes his lightsaber and he's like gung-ho. Who does he encounter in the cave? Darth Vader. He's not supposed to do anything. But he gets into a fight with him. He releases, as it were, his dark impulses. Then he cuts Darth Vader's head off, and when he sees who is beneath the helmet, who is it? Himself. Yeah? So the hero encounters in the special world, ultimately, only mirror images of himself. Now here it's a bit more complicated, that Obi-Wan is ultimately what Luke needs to become, but Obi-Wan's mirror image is Darth Vader. In the second part, right in the middle, which is the middle of the whole trilogy, Luke encounters himself in his enemy. He knows that if he releases the anger that is in him, the aggression that is in him, he will become Darth Vader. So you can actually apply the hero's journey model either to Star Wars individually, or you can apply it to all three films. And then at the middle, you find the supreme ordeal for all three films, which is an encounter with yourself in this case, very literally. Okay, so we've had tests, allies and enemies. Then we have approach to the inmost cave, which leads, this is too small, it's an odd shape, it should, you know, be longer. Okay, so, we have tests, allies, enemies, we have, what did I say?
God.
Approach to the inmost cave, and supreme ordeal. So what's the supreme ordeal and what's the approach to the inmost cave, where the supreme ordeal takes place? What's the supreme ordeal for Luke in this film?
One is trapped in a trash maker with the tentacle monster.
Yeah? Okay. let's say the supreme ordeal, we can stage it by putting the hero in the worst place in the universe to be. Yeah? So what would be the worst place of the universe to be? Let's say there's a very powerful enemy. Let's say that powerful enemy has a very powerful weapon. That would be a bad place to be. Let's say in that powerful weapon is a prison. That would be a really bad place to be. Let's say underneath that prison is a trash contractor. That would be the worst place to be. And let's say the trash contractor contracts and you get sucked underwater. Yeah, that's a good supreme ordeal. You're sucked underwater in a contracting trash contractor underneath the prison in the ultimate weapon of the evil emperor. Yeah, that's a good supreme ordeal. And what is the supreme ordeal about? It's about rebirth. You have to die. In a sense, you have to die three times in the hero's journey. You die when you make the transition from the ordinary world to the special world, because you will be completely transformed. And this is hinted at by Luke almost getting killed in the cantina. Supreme ordeal, he gets sucked underwater, and for a few seconds, we don't know whether he will ever come back. Okay, now, approach to the inmate's cave means just, you know, they get the tractor beams, suck them into the supreme ordeal. So it's not like he willingly goes in there, he accidentally goes in there. What's the sexual dimension of the supreme ordeal, if any? After all, it's rebirth, death and rebirth. Do you see a sexual dimension? And do you dare to talk about it? Okay, the Death Star is a piece of technology, we would say male-identified. But what does it look like? It looks round, looks a bit like a moon, and the moon is very clearly associated with a female body. Okay? Now, what do you make of the trash contractor? And that thing that comes out, grabs him, and sucks him in. What do you make of that? You don't dare say anything. Isn't it a bit like a birth canal? The contractions? And there is the umbilical cord. But instead of popping out, the imagery in this film has our hero basically be in the birth canal, which is contracting, and he's sucked back in into something which is a female-identified moon-like structure. It's not a pleasant view of the female body. After all, it's a trash contractor down there. But it's certainly a very powerful view. Yeah? Because you need to think about, it's all about men, isn't it? It's about Luke and not Leia. You know, it's about Obi-Wan. And no one ever mentions Luke's mother. It's all very male. But what are the most powerful things in this universe? There's the Death Star. And as I said, the Death Star, in terms of its roundness and everything, and in terms of what I just talked about, is actually female-identified. And the Force. Is the Force like a patriarchal god? A male god? The Force is everywhere. It surrounds us. Yeah? When might you ever have experienced being part of the Force? Completely at ease, in touch with your surroundings. Yeah? In the womb! You know, being in touch with the Force is like being in the womb. So I would say, the interesting thing is, while this is a story about men, the most powerful forces, allegorically, symbolically, whatever you call it, in this story are actually female-identified. They have to do, ultimately, with the womb. And as I said, the supreme ordeal is in this very hostile version, this very nightmarish version of what the womb is. The womb that doesn't let you go, the womb where you think you enter the world, but then the umbilical cord grabs you and sucks you back in. Yeah, that's the moment of rebirth. He gets sucked back in. There's a few seconds where you think he will never come out again, he's dead, and then he pops out again. Then he still has the contractions to deal with, but they eventually manage that. Okay, now once you have the supreme ordeal, you get a reward. Once you've gone through the supreme ordeal, you get a reward. What's the reward that Luke gets out of the supreme ordeal? What does he have afterwards that he didn't have before?
Blueprints from Death Star.
Yeah, so there's the blueprints. So that's a technical solution to a problem. Blueprints, yeah. What else? Hey, he gets a girl. You know, the film is very self-aware. You know, the first time he sees her, and she says, aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper? So the film's obsession with male size is played on very funnily here. Aren't you a bit short for a stormtrooper? She says to him. But he gets a girl. Now, it's not his girl yet, but, you know, he gets the blueprints, he gets the girl. Does he get anything else after the supreme ordeal?
They get out.
Yeah, anything else? Well, the supreme ordeal is immediately followed by Obi-Wan sacrificing himself. Does he get anything out of that? Is it just more trauma, or does he get a reward for having lived through that ordeal of not only being reborn in the trash contractor, but also having seen Obi-Wan die? Does he get a reward from that? It's a voice. Run, Luke, run. Yeah, for the first time, he hears a voice from beyond death. So he gets life after death experience. For the first time. Because Obi-Wan gets killed, then they try to get away, and then he suddenly hears that voice, run, Luke, run. So he has evidence that there's life after death. So that's a pretty good, you know, he gets the blueprints, he gets a girl, and he has life after death. I think that's a pretty good wage for a day's work there. Now, after the hero gets the reward, he goes on the road back, and that's where it gets a bit murky in this film, because he never goes back to Tatooine, so this gets all a bit murky. And the importance of the road back is that the special world, once you have entered it, you can't just leave it. Yeah, it's such a profound transformation experience that you can't just leave it behind. You can't just go back, you know, and go back to the farm and continue with your life. Because in a sense, the special world reaches after you into the ordinary world and grabs you and holds you. And that leads to the a confrontation. The biggest confrontation in a story often happens after the hero returns from the special world. In this case, he returns to the rebel planet, or rebel moon. And interestingly, it isn't the special world which hope brings him back, but he decides to go back, because they have to attack the Death Star. And that's usually the climactic battle here. So that's when the hero wants to leave the ordinary world behind, but he can't yet, because the special world has exerted such a powerful influence on him. And out of this battle that takes place in that last section, after the road back, comes a resurrection. So the hero, in a sense, dies again and is reborn again. And then at the very end, we have the return with the elixir. And that's at the very end. That bit doesn't work very well. And I think partly it has to do with the fact that that Lucas didn't know. I mean, I told you that when Lucas wrote the film and made it, he thought it would be a financial disaster. So he thought there would never be a sequel. But he had written a story which was enough for 9 films. And this was the 4th in the series. So it has a clear beginning and it has a clear development until about this part. Here it gets very murky what's going on. But the big battle at which the hero is reborn again comes in that final part. How does that happen in Star Wars? How does the hero have a big battle and get reborn yet again?
He flies through the thick ventilation shaft in Death Star.
How is that a rebirth for him?
I don't know. Again, the canal.
Okay. That's like the, you know, like a Woody Allen, like, you know, sperm being planted in the moon. Yeah. He can go there, but we don't have to. What's the most obvious thing to say he's reborn?
Well, he's nearly died.
Yeah, Darth Vader is on his tail. He almost gets killed. And then, of course, trust the Force, Luke. And that's the real rebirth. There's the moment of death, when Darth Vader almost kills him. And then the moment of rebirth, when he trusts the Force, switches off all the guidance systems, gives up on technology, and just becomes, you know, as it were, a vehicle for the Force to do good. That's the real rebirth. For the first time, he does something that a Jedi does. When he did a little bit of that, when he fought that training thingamajig, but for the first time, he really acts like a Jedi. He really accesses the Force in order to fulfill the mission. So again, the technological side of it is completely irrelevant. The spiritual side is what the film emphasizes. The return with Elixir is not very good because it looks like a fascist, you know, Nuremberg-style rally. You know, it's all a bit, they never get the medal to the Wookiee. You know, it's all a bit messy. So I'm not very happy with the return with Elixir. Because Elixir is when the hero brings what he has learned and gives it as a gift, as it were, to everyone he knows, to his whole society. The whole society can be reborn through the hero, and that doesn't happen. But I think it has a lot to do with Lucas knowing that he needed to leave things open for potential sequels, although he was skeptical whether there ever would be one. Are there particular things which, apart from the love triangle, is there anything else which is unresolved at the end of the film? Yeah. Darth Vader is hit by Han Solo, but he just flies off. Yeah, he's not killed. The other thing that is unresolved is, of course, the evil Emperor still, you know, I don't think whether he's ever mentioned, but we know that someone has taken over the Senate and is controlling it dictatorially. That hasn't been resolved. Just their most powerful weapon has been destroyed, but that hasn't been resolved yet. So the political situation isn't really resolved. But more importantly, the main enemy, who is a mirror image of Obi-Wan, the mentor, and is the killer of Luke's father, we've been told, that hasn't been resolved at all, because he just flies off. And the love triangle hasn't been resolved. Okay, well that's it. I'm not very happy with the road back. The resurrection is great, that's great, but the road back, you know, because he never flies back, that's very disappointing. And the return with Elixir is a bit too Leni Riefenstahl for me. So I'm not very happy with that. Now what you can do is you can say, okay, what's Darth Vader's hero's journey? In order to tell that journey, you need all six films. Yeah? That hero's journey starts with a young boy who is separated from his mother. His ordinary world is on Tatooine, but he's separated from his mother. There's this terrible scene where, oh, mom, you know, and he's taken away. And he gets attached to someone who steps in for his mother. Padme. In the second part, guess what? He falls in love with Padme. He's told that a Jedi must not know anger, nor hatred, nor love. He falls in love with Padme because he has wet dreams about her. Confusingly, he also dreams of his mum being killed. You know, Oedipal Schmeedipal. He dreams of his mum, and he dreams of the woman who has replaced his mum, and he wants to protect one and sleep with the other. It's very, very Freudian. Yeah, so that's the second part. In the third part, there's a prophecy that she will die. The very attempt of preventing her to die causes her to die. It's a beautiful concept. You might hate the prequels, but they're beautifully done in terms of the story. In the third part, the very attempt to protect the life of his love, who stands in for his mother, who he has lost twice, one first by being separated, second by her being killed, by trying to protect her, he causes her death. Then in part four, he encounters his son and immediately recognizes there's something special about this one. And what he recognizes is that that loop will become the vehicle of his own redemption. Yeah, he's trapped in the special world, in an evil version of the special world, but he recognizes after his supreme ordeal is the end of part three. The end of part three, he realizes that his very attempt to protect his wife causes her to die. That's what he realizes at the very end of part three. That's his supreme ordeal. But in part four, he realizes, he begins to get a sense that Luke is the vehicle for him to redeem himself. And in part six, he does precisely that. How is the Star Wars saga resolved in part six? It's not technology. It's not the military. It's not even the Force. Part six is about Luke saying to his father, I know you're still in there, and I know there's still good in you. And then Darth Vader says, all right then. It's not even, you know, my access to the Force is more powerful than your access to the Force. It's just a boy saying to his father, I know you're in there, you still love me. And the father saying, yes, I do, son. Yeah, that's how it all ends. So that would be Darth Vader's hero's journey. There's a long part in the special world where he's turned to evil, but he finds in Luke a vehicle to redeem himself at the very end. And then, of course, he returns as a, you know, the final celebrations, he returns as a ghost, together with Yoda and, what's his name?
Obi-Wan.
Now, the one question that is never answered in all of this, we know that Anakin's... The problem with the second trilogy is that we only hear one sentence about Luke and Leia's mother. Do you know what that sentence is? You know, when Luke and Leia realize they're brother and sister, and then they talk about their mother, and all they say is, she was beautiful. Which, incidentally, is what Luke said when he first said, so, guess what? Leia! Yeah, what is going on here? So, in a sense, the second trilogy is all about the lost father. And Luke George Lucas had to make the prequel trilogy in order to address the question of mothers. Yeah, Padme, who is Luke's mother, Luke's and Leia's mother, and Anakin's mother are at the center of the story of the prequel trilogy. So there is a balance there that the absent females, who are only represented allegorically through the Death Star and through the Force, become the center of the narrative in relation to the hero in the prequel trilogy. You can tell the story of, you can analyze all of this in terms of Han Solo's hero's journey across the parts 4 to 6. You can probably do it for Obi-Wan's hero's journey across all 6 parts, maybe. Or you can do bits of it. So what I'm saying is that, in a sense, the idea of extending a narrative is at the heart of popular storytelling. It's not some modern invention for marketing reasons that you continue telling a story, because in the hero's journey, there's always characters who can... Someone who has completed the hero's journey should come back in another story where there are some new hero's mentor, or some villain in one hero's journey. You need to show how that villain became a villain. So what was their hero's journey and what went wrong along it? And I think that's what Lucas did with those 6 episodes, and that's what I think J.J. Abrams, who is in charge of everything in the world, is now going to do. He's going to, you know, expand that universe. And I don't know how many of you have read all the novels, but I don't know, there's about 100 novels or so, and there's a television series and God knows what all, and Lucas tried to have them all interconnected. But what I'm saying is, that's not just a marketing ploy. It's just inherent in the hero's journey that, although it is enclosed in itself, it doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end, but it's also open. Because each character can go on another hero's journey, or become the mentor, or turn evil, to become a villain in the next hero's journey. Okay, any questions about this? Any questions? What time have we gone? Hey, I'm ahead of time. Because I scheduled this for 1.5 hours. So we can have a proper break. But let's just have 10 minutes or so. But are there any questions about this? You guys never say anything, do you? You just think, we're going to show him. No Jedi mind trick will make us say anything. You can apply this. If you do it mechanically, it's boring. But if you ask yourself, what are the problems in the ordinary world? Like, let's say your problem would be you have a job that demands that you're very fit. Then you have an accident and you're not fit anymore. Let's say you're sitting in a wheelchair. Let's say you also lose someone who's close to you. You haven't got many people, but you lose someone. Let's say that through that person you get a chance, but what you get a chance to do, you're totally ill-equipped for. You're not educated enough to do it, and you're not fit enough to do it. Yeah, that's an everyday situation. It's a pretty bad everyday situation, but that's not anything special, really. That's an ordinary world experience. But that's the starting point of Avatar. And you can do that with most films. You can see in the ordinary world, and the protagonist, the way he starts or she starts out, you can boil it down to very, very everyday situations and problems, often very fundamental ones, like how to deal with death. And the whole special world, the whole fantasy setting, is only there to get you to resolve these things, not only for yourself, but also for the whole society of which you are part. And you can apply these categories here to virtually every story. By the way, it also works, of course, for non-science fiction, non-fantasy stories. It works for love stories as well, obviously. There, the special world is that special connection between the lovers. So you start out with someone in their ordinary world who looks for love but can't find it. Then they see the one that they will fall in love with. That changes everything. So suddenly they're in the special world. Then, of course, all kinds of horrible things happen in the special world. You know, a lot of things could go terribly wrong. And probably the hero at some point, or the heroine, wants to return to their everyday life. But somehow that connection that they made with that special other is so strong that they can't return. So Julia Roberts can't run away from Richard Gere in Pretty Woman. He will come after her, you know. He will not let her go. And then, of course, the ordinary world is transformed, because now that love, which only existed in the special world, becomes part of a reality. It's not a fantasy, alternative reality anymore. It becomes part of the real world. How real that would be between Julia Roberts and Richard Gere in Pretty Woman, I don't think that would work. But that's not the point, you know. So you can apply this to any kind of story. It works best with fantasy or science fiction, epic fantasy and science fiction stories, or otherwise, you know, fantastically oriented stories. But it works for any kind of story, including love stories. So you can do that. But as I said, it works best when you don't do it mechanically, just ticking boxes, but when you really think, what is the person risking when they enter the special world? You know, what might they lose? And the more they're likely to lose, the better the story really is. If they can lose everything, including their soul, and that's really a great risk to take. And only from that great risk come the great rewards. And the great rewards are never for the individual alone. They're always for the community that they service or that they come from. Okay, 10-minute break.